It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you like to read fiction, think about your favorite author, one you'd read like anything and everything they wrote. Now suppose a computer algorithm scanned all of that too and then wrote its own book in the style of your favorite author. Would you want to read it? Would you be glad to have more? Or would you be offended at the computer imitation? These are not really hypothetical questions anymore. Last week, a group of 17 best-selling authors brought a class-action lawsuit against OpenAI, creator of the ChatGPT chatbot. The authors, including names like John Grisham and George R.R. Martin, say that OpenAI used their copyrighted works to train ChatGPT without their permission. The lawsuit also claims that programs like ChatGPT harm the writing industry as a whole, making it harder for writers to earn a living wage. Similar claims have come up in the Writers Guild of America strike. That group represents writers in Hollywood and other media industries. That was an issue in the months-long writer's strike, which may end after a tentative deal announced today. Our next guest thinks a lot about so-called artificial intelligence and what it means for humans, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of artificial intelligence programs being trained on copyrighted works by authors, real authors, without their permission? Are you optimistic or worried about how these chatbot programs could transform reading and writing? Would you want to read that hypothetical, not so hypothetical AI-authored book that imitates your favorite writer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Robin Zabrowski is an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. Robin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Artificial intelligence and these chatbots and large language models and all these other things, in some ways seem to have come out of nowhere, Robin, and they're suddenly transforming so many different lines of work, including creativity and, yes, writing. Can you talk a little bit about how this became such a big part of our culture and opened up so many questions?
Yeah, so they haven't really come out of nowhere. We've had the technology that does this for decades. They're not wildly different than the expert systems and neural nets we had in the 1980s. What's really different is the ability of folks to gather giant data sets. So before we had all of the various ways that our data is sucked up everywhere in the real world and online, there wasn't enough data in order to train these things to be that good. But now that we have these large data sets, I mean, this is exactly how we get ChatGPT out of almost nowhere. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Now let's get into authoring books here. Let's go with George R.R. Martin, because one of the cases they give in this lawsuit is ChatGPT was able to output an outline of a prequel to his Song of Ice and Fire called A Dawn of Direwolves, using actual characters he created, things like that. Would a book by a chatbot that read all of George R.R. Martin's books be a George R.R. Martin book, if I can get philosophical?
I certainly don't think so. I think that I haven't actually read George R.R. Martin, but I feel like his books probably have some, you know, like they introduce new things. And that's really important. Sometimes I have a writer that I'll read for decades and I'll love most of their work, and then they'll take a different turn and I'll be like, it's not quite as good, but like, I get why they don't want to write the same thing for their entire lives. Importantly, these bots that do this, they're not exactly doing something new. They're just taking the structures about things like stories that they've learned, and then, of course, the language and something like the style from the George R.R. Martin books that were in the training set, and just kind of putting them in a blender and spitting them back out. I have very little interest in books like written like that. I'm much more interested in the actual authors writing things.
Now, this comes up because of this lawsuit we mentioned, and there are others from authors against the companies behind these ChatGPT and other chatbots. So this is getting into the legal world here. It seems like we have a legal system that determines if, you know, if I started writing a book using characters that somebody else created that were still under copyright, well, I know that I'd be accused of plagiarism, and rightly so. How much does this chatbot concept shake things up in the legal world, do you think?
I think part of the problem is that we've known that things like this were coming for a long time, and there's been a branch of AI ethics, right? People thinking about these problems and anticipating them for decades. Back in the 90s, when I was in graduate school, there were people doing AI ethics way before we had AI. And I think the most depressing thing about the current moment is that nobody listened to any of them. Because like we could have predicted things like this would happen. And we tried to get people to anticipate this with law, and just nobody took any of it very seriously. And I think the legal part is still really messy. I think it probably is of a type with like fan fiction, right? On the one hand, I think that people being allowed to write fan fiction is awesome. But I know that there have been big legal battles mm-hmm. with fan fiction communities as well. And I think that this is similar, but somehow different, although putting my finger on exactly how it's different is really tricky.
Another part of the story here is, okay, if I'm running a company designing some sort of chatbot, I'm looking for that big data you mentioned. I'm running all this material I found on the internet, and well, it includes novels by these authors, and I didn't ask them if I could do this. Is that wrong of me? Should I have gotten permission first?
Yeah, it seems like uncontroversially true to me that it was not correct of them to do this. Probably they did it in part because they didn't realize how successful the product would be. And because there's lots of like cobbling data sets together around what's publicly available all over people working on neural networks. I just think they didn't realize what would happen if the product was as successful as they hoped it would be. But as soon as you realize that, like right after ChatGPT was released to the public, Microsoft handed them $10 billion. Like they had to realize they could not be profiting off all this work that wasn't theirs.
We are talking about so-called artificial intelligence programs, how they use copyrighted work by existing authors, and artists and other creative types, by the way. You could join in with your thoughts on all this, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you used a chatbot of some sort for, I don't know what, to write a paper, a first draft, to do a report for work, to make an image for a pamphlet or an ad or something? Join in at 800-642-1234. Robin, authors aren't the first people to raise these concerns. We've seen stories about artists also, because there's a lot of things you can go to online to say, hey, make me an image of blank, blank, and blank. And wow, these online things are pretty good at creating images, except the artists say, well, they're good at it because they scanned in lots of works by existing artists in the first place.
Yeah, I remember I can't remember exactly when, but yeah, Sarah Anderson of Sarah's Scribbles, which is just a really fabulous webcomic, and two other artists brought a lawsuit against, who was it, Stability AI and Midjourney, and I think DeviantArt, all to say our work was stolen and used to train these machines, which now are directly putting us out of work, right? So lots of places that were already grudgingly paying artists for their work now can just do things in the style of these artists. And they don't have to pay anyone to do that. And it seems so deeply problematic in the same way that sort of George R.R. Martin and all the other people on the author lawsuit are noticing that it's like, you know, directly affecting their bottom line.
I want to talk about the nature of these ChatGPT and other similar concepts and programs and algorithms. I think when we look at the output we get from them, it's easy to think, oh, they're creative. They write like people or draw like people or whatever. The linguist Emily Bender wrote about artificial intelligence as a stochastic parrot and warned that we shouldn't attribute creativity or intentionality to these kind of programs. I'm guessing these are things you've thought about a lot. What do you think?
Yeah, the Stochastic Parrots paper shook the AI ethics world up a lot when it was released. It set off this ridiculous storm where two of the authors were fired from Google for writing it, even though it was their job. They were employed by Google as AI ethicists. And so they're supposed to be anticipating and pointing out ways that the company may not be performing ethically. And one was just a very public firing. Tim McGabrew basically got fired on Twitter for being one of the authors of this paper. And I think the paper was brilliant in part because the stochastic parrot's imagery is just wonderful, right? The idea that it is parroting the text and the ideas and the structures of language that it's been fed, but it's also just sort of mixing them up enough to look like something new. And it's not new. It's maybe not direct plagiarism, but it's absolutely just sort of shaking up all the text it's been given and spitting it out based on a probability, how likely one word is to follow another.
We're talking to Robin Zabrowski, an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. We're talking about a group of prominent authors bringing a lawsuit against OpenAI, the makers of ChatGPT, and what it all means for creativity and the books we read. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy reading? If so, are you worried about text maybe being written by artificial intelligence programs? Are you a writer? How has AI impacted you in your profession? Have you played around with any of these so-called AI chatbots of one sort or another, played or worked with one? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Robin Zabrowski, professor of cognitive science at Beloit College, about a lawsuit brought against OpenAI by a group of prominent authors, including George R.R. Martin and Jonathan Franzen, many others saying, hey, you scanned our works without getting permission, and now your programs can output things like our works without our permission. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to hearing about that suit? What is your take on AI generating more of what we read? Will it free up humans to do other things? Will we be worse off? If you are a creative type yourself, are you worried about some of these artificial intelligence creations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Deborah's with us in Madison. Deborah, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I use chat. I'm a freelance blogger, and I do that for some small companies. And I use ChatGPT to put together a blog, and it came up with a great title, great lead-in paragraph, was pretty much empty of content that was, you know, really had any substance to it. But I can see that very soon the machine will learn enough to be able to come up with good blogs, and soon companies won't need people like me that are just making, you know, money just writing these blogs for people. And so I think very soon freelancers like me will be out of a job.
Deborah, do you think there are things that you, Deborah, bring to the table that, you know, are unique and that maybe would be hard to replace with another person or with a chatbot or what have you? I'm sorry, we're losing the line, Deborah. But Robin, Deborah's point well taken. She provides a service now. She sees maybe it's not quite there yet, but she sees a time when companies might just use these programs instead of going to her.
Yeah, I mean, this is already happening, right? We're seeing lots of newsrooms that are laying off journalists to do exactly this. And we also saw a lot of this happen recently where I don't want to badmouth a particular network, but somebody basically fired a department and deployed stories written by ChatGPT and within days had to suspend that because the stories were factually incorrect, poorly written, and had to walk a whole bunch of stuff back. So I think that on the one hand, we shouldn't overestimate the power of these things. They can give some convincing but factually disastrous results. But also, I would hope that Deborah in her job is not using these tools because all that's going to do is help automate her out of a job. Because I'm pretty sure OpenAI is clear in their terms of service that the ways that you use this mm-hmm. service are then getting fed back in to train new models. So I would encourage many of my writer and artist friends not to participate because you're scabbing, basically. You're going to work yourself out of a job.
Deborah, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. That reminds me of a couple of stories I've seen, Robin. A lawyer using a chat program to come up with a legal brief that looked just right and the format was great and it referred to legal precedents that had never, ever existed. Concerns from a mushroom foraging society that there were books showing up on Amazon, clearly written by artificial intelligence, with bad information about which mushrooms are safe, which doesn't sound good to me. I mean, is there going to be a point where we realize we set standards for how much human oversight there has to be on something we create with these?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think that the ways that it is factually incorrect just belies the fact that most people don't understand how these systems work. They're never going to be like truth-telling systems. The way they're designed is they have to have taken in so much text that they can spit out reasonable appearing responses, but there's absolutely nothing about the code that would ever enable the guarantee that they are factual in any way. And I just think this is deeply problematic, right? Because I know that the Writers Guild recently started, I think it's not official, but they think they reached a settlement and the AI stuff was a big sticking point. Because it's happening all over where people are just hiring writers to fix the factual pieces that are all broken. And it just seems so problematic. And it's a part of the technology, like it's an inherent part of how the technology works, that there is not a way for it to be guaranteed factual. And we've seen some of that go very badly. That poor lawyer who had no idea how the technology worked because OpenAI released it with no instruction of exactly what it's doing. And so lots of people are fooled into thinking that it's not just grammatical, but that it's factually correct.
Talking to Robin Zabrowski from Beloit College about the various chatbots, OpenAI programs out there, the ethical issues they're raising. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Another issue, Robin, is that, okay, we've got these, I think, artificial intelligence style programs optimizing our search results, saying, okay, here's what I'm going to show you first when you search for, I don't know, recipe for zucchini or whatever. And then other people writing their blogs and whatnot to capture the attention of that. Are we going to get this feedback loop where we're our artificial intelligence programs are writing things to be detected by other artificial intelligence programs?
Yes. And I think it's already happening. Like I've seen in the past maybe 6 months or so, lots of people sort of bemoaning the loss of Google search. I don't know how much you use it, but if you use Google search now, the results just seem worse than they used to be.
Definitely.
Google sort of stole the whole market by having the best algorithm back in the early days. But it's just unreliable and it's so bloated by people who pay to increase their rankings, and it's just not very useful anymore. And it's only going to be a bigger problem. And in fact, there are folks who think we've hit as good as these chatbots will ever get, in part because they're trained on so much of the internet. And now that so much of the internet is being populated by AI generated text, we're going to start seeing this messiness emerge, and it's going to get worse and worse.
Another concern I know, Robin, is the ability to produce misinformation in volume. If I want to start a misinformation campaign, I could by hand create a bunch of social media accounts and then by hand type up things and paste them in. Well, now I can have a whole bunch of different OpenAI programs with different photos attached to them and maybe even slightly different personalities flooding every comment section and social media outlet in the world.
Yeah, and I think we are seeing some of that. Yeah, it's funny. We think like we don't want them to put artists and writers out of work, but then you hear about, you know, like the enormous troll farms that are peddling disinformation around the world. And we kind of do want to put them out of work, except the result is still that much misinformation all over the place. And I do think that the way these systems were released, and this is really on those companies for having done it this way, but I think that it's sort of like the cat is out of the bag. It's really hard to backtrack now that the code is out there and that, yes, like we can produce misinformation at wild scales that was not possible before.
Time for one more caller. Don is with us in Madison. Don, hello.
Yeah, hi. So I just had a comment. So I have five kids, and two are in high school and three are in college. And when this, you know, AI came out a couple, you know, a year ago, you know, I'd actually use it to try to, like, you know, help them in some ways. And at first it seemed like a good idea, but then what we would find, especially with college stuff, is that AI would think it knew something that was factual, and it would write something to help us. And then we'd actually fact check it against what we were learning in the class. And it was not, you know, many times it was inaccurate. So we ended up just totally giving up on even, you know, utilizing it. I do think that AI has been helpful for my children, at least, not to write papers for them, but to give them suggestions on how to write specific, like they're trying to figure out how to write something specifically. And I've noticed not necessarily that their work is, you know, AI like, but that they've learned how to frame things in you know, papers better than they used to.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. We just have a few moments left, Robin. Your thoughts on AI and education, big issue with just a few moments left.
Yes, huge issue. I think that the caller is absolutely right that it can give people who are in some way especially disadvantaged second language learners, it can be a real benefit to help them understand the structure of writing. But he's hit it right on the head that it's such a disaster factually that I think there are a lot of students using it and getting bad grades as a result because they're just not anywhere near the realm of reality.
Thanks for that call, Don. And Robin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Robin Zabrowski, an AI theorist and professor of cognitive science at Beloit College. We've been talking about a new lawsuit brought against the makers of ChatGPT by a bunch of big-name authors and how artificial intelligence is changing the game for writers and many others as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Biden administration announced it's launching a new White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. President Biden said on Friday that the office will have four main objectives.
First, to expedite the implementation of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act and the executive actions already announced. And I mean it. We're going to fully implement them. Second, coordinate more support for survivors, families and communities affected by gun violence, including mental health care, financial assistance, the same way FEMA responds to natural disasters. Same way. And helps folks recover and rebuild and alter. Look, folks, shootings are the ultimate superstorm, ripping through communities. Third, identify new executive actions we can take within our legal authority to reduce gun violence. And fourth, expand our coalition of partners in states and cities across America.
The Biden administration has pushed for an assault weapons ban and other gun control legislation, but has gotten little movement from Congress outside of the bipartisan Safer Communities Act passed last year. Gun safety advocates are praising the formation of the office as a step in the right direction in the absence of further legislative action. According to the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, the U.S. stands out among high-income countries around the world. Quoting from a report last year, age-adjusted firearm homicide rates in the U.S. are 22 times greater than in the European Union, 23 times greater than in Australia. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the White House forming this Office of Gun Violence Prevention? Do you think it could make a difference? What would you want to see from the White House? And how about from Congress when it comes to preventing gun violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Theodore Lentz is an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UW-Milwaukee. He researches the criminal legal system, gun violence, and community justice. Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Big picture, how significant is this to have this White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention?
Big picture, I think this is a really positive step forward. Anytime you're bringing more resources to address any issue or any problem that we're having, you know, it signals that more effort is going to be put into this problem. You know, of course, it depends the degree to which it's going to make a difference is going to depend on what they're actually going to do, how much funding will be coming through them, what the funding will be used for, et cetera. But I think it's an important step and an important signal that we're going to start taking gun violence more seriously.
When we look over the last few decades, we've saw peaks in homicides, often gun homicides in the 80s and 90s. They declined for a while, went back up in conjunction with COVID. But compared, as I mentioned in that report, to other countries, our rates are generally pretty high compared to other comparable nations like in Europe, in Australia. Do we pay attention to that number? Is this just something we take for granted in the U.S., do you think?
I don't know. I mean, Americans, you know, tend to think of us as an outlier, and I think that we are an outlier, certainly when it comes to gun violence. And I think that it's an important sign of something. I mean, in American culture, I think that gun violence is part of it in a lot of ways, and the, you know, widespread availability of firearms. You know, there's a lot of reasons why we as a country have a much larger problem with gun violence than others.
We heard President Biden there list the fourth point, aiming at expanding a coalition of partners in states and cities across America to deal with gun violence. You've done some work, I understand, with community groups aimed at preventing gun violence victimization. Can you talk about what kind of programs you've seen?
Yeah, sure. The community-based approaches to gun violence prevention tend to work. They use sort of a different strategy. Usually it's a more of a public health approach to gun violence prevention. And that approach is kind of identifying, well, you know, what is the problem? What are the causes and the risk factors? And then, you know, when we find out what works to address some of those, what do we do about it? And community-based approaches are, I would say, increasingly being used across the U.S., where you're really bringing the existing community resources into the strategy, rather than relying entirely, for instance, on law enforcement to use, you know, what they typically do, you know, which is investigate incidents, making arrests, things like that. The public health approach, the, you know, community-based approaches, that they also violence interruption, for instance, is one common strategy. Violence interruption works on this idea that you know, that gun violence, it's not a random event. It's concentrated in geographic space. There are certain places that are at much higher risk than other places, and it's also concentrated among people. A lot of times, when you look at perpetrators of gun violence, it's a relatively small number of people that are believed to be responsible for the majority of the violence. And so, identifying who those people are, and then finding ways to interrupt the potential violent conflicts. In some cities, we're seeing where these community organizations are hiring folks from the community, people that can serve sort of as credible messengers to bring about a, you know, a message of nonviolence and trying to stop the violence. And they can also work with hospitals, trauma centers. We see that here in Milwaukee, where there are dedicated folks, staff members at hospitals that are responding to when someone comes in with a shooting injury, and they're able then to kind of figure out what services are needed, how to provide more support for that individual, for their families, their friends, and their community. You know, it's another touch point where we can start to get down into what are the underlying causes, what sort of social context is allowing violence to thrive in this way. And so thinking outside of just law enforcement strategies is one way that that we're seeing some promise.
When I've talked to other people about violence interrupter programs, it seems like some communities have had a pattern that goes something like this. A community gets grants to start up a program like this. It shows some signs of promise. The grant runs out. They scramble to sustain it, but without the initial funding, it's hard to keep going. Are you hoping that maybe something like this announcement from the White House could start to create more sustainable frameworks where you do it not just for whatever, a 3-year grant period or something, but have a permanent sort of violence interruption program?
Yeah, that's a great point. That tends to be the case where you have, some soft money that's supporting these initiatives. And then, sometimes it takes a while too. Some of trying to change cultural norms around the use of firearms and violence to settle disputes and things like that, it can take some time. And so, sustainability of these programs is really hard. They tend to be really expensive. It takes a lot of people power. It takes a lot of institutional power to maintain these programs and these initiatives. And so, yes, definitely. And it, back to the first point that anytime you're going to bring more potentially bring more resources to the issue, it should be it can be a positive thing, because that is kind of the Achilles heel of a lot of community-based prevention work.
Talking to Ted Lentz, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UW-Milwaukee, talking about efforts to bring down gun violence in the United States. The White House announced a new Office for Gun Violence Prevention late last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think might work? What do you worry about when you hear about programs like this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Mark?
Well, so on the surface, it sounds great, a new government office to address what's obviously a serious problem, living in a major metropolitan city. Clearly gun violence is a problem, but even in the president's message, he seems to be rolling like his whole agenda into one. He mentioned these, what we call the so-called assault weapon ban, because nobody can really define what an assault weapon is. There's supposed to be checks and balance. That's checks and balances. That's where government was set up. And the ATF is clearly overreached. The governor of New Mexico recently tried a huge overreach, and they're using this public health emergency concept that worked so well during COVID to try to exert executive power over things that the legislature doesn't want to take on.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there from Mark. The New Mexico issue, he mentioned the governor, the latest there, declared a public health effort, saying that overrides the ability of people to carry guns publicly. Ted, as Mark mentioned, a lot of checks and balances issues, a lot of constitutional issues that we might run up against as we try to think of solutions to gun violence. Does that make things complicated, or do you think there's a lot of room to work even within that?
A little bit of both. Obviously, those constitutional issues, the political issues that are just historically and contemporarily making it difficult for developing policy. But I think taking a bit of a step back in the broader context of if we are kind of taking this public health approach, I mean, we've identified a problem, right? We're starting to collect systematically more data so we can start tracking, is this problem getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? Who's affected? You know, are there important disparities to consider, et cetera? And then once you're able to do that, then you start thinking about, well, what are the causes and the risk factors? Before you can start talking about, well, what works and how do we do more of what works? And so I think the, at least the research community is, you know, we're just starting to get into the what works question, starting to do more evaluations. You know, there are obviously case studies and things like that that we can work from, but we still don't have a good sense of what works. There was a big effort by a private research organization at one point to look at gun policies and their effects. And basically the research is not strong enough to make any firm conclusions about what works and what doesn't. And so, you know, from a researcher standpoint, I think that the research community is in a really important place right now where, you know, we do need the resources in order to start tapping into these questions and trying to answer them so that we can develop policies that are rooted in what we know about gun violence.
We're talking to UW-Milwaukee criminal justice and criminology professor Ted Lentz about the White House launching a new Office for Gun Violence Prevention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important an issue is gun violence prevention to you? Whose responsibility is it to reduce gun violence? Do you want to see the Biden administration and or Congress do more to tackle the issue? Have you seen efforts maybe in your own community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ted Lentz. He's an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UW-Milwaukee, who studies gun violence, community response, and the criminal legal system. He's with us today for a look at the newly announced White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, what impact it might have on the issue, and what we do and don't know about preventing gun violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I'm very much in favor of this initiative by the White House. I feel that we have to take more and more creative ways to combat this issue. I think that we have been kind of beat up and cornered with our own Constitution. These Second Amendment advocates have kind of put us in a position where we have no other choice but to do this. So I hope that the funding is there. I hope that it stays, and I hope that it grows. I think this is one solution of many we have to go after.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Ted, does our divisive politics when it comes to guns and gun control interfere, you think, with the work you were talking about earlier of trying to figure out causes of gun violence and measure solutions and whether and how they work?
I mean, it gets in the way insofar as it prevents the resources, the funding needed to do good research. You know, if the funding is not there, or it's very, you know, inconsistent and unstable, it makes it difficult to really evaluate a program or a strategy or a policy for its effectiveness. You know, in the same way that we would, you know, we got to know how, you know, it's about creating data systems and things like that, again, to track changes over time so that we can start identifying the ones that do and don't work. And if we're constantly kind of taking our foot off the gas, it leaves these gaps in the research. It leaves gaps in, you know, if you think of it like a public health problem, in the dosage of the treatment that communities are receiving. You know, if that's intermittent and it's not consistent, it's not stable, that makes it really hard not only for the program or the policy work or to be effective as it was intended to be, but also for the research community to be able to give us some better answers as to the effectiveness questions.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard President Biden earlier refer to that previously passed piece of legislation, the bipartisan Safer Communities Act. One of the things that does is go out and works with schools, or at least that's the goal, giving grants to schools to, quote, create, to establish safer and healthier learning environments, prevent and respond to acts of bullying, violence, and hate, and also to give mental health support to schools. Ted, how much can we do at the school level when it comes to supporting students and, I guess, using the educational process to help prevent violence?
Well, I think it's really important to get as many folks at the table as we can to deal with this problem. It's not just a law enforcement problem. It's not just a mental health system problem. It's not just an education, educational or a lot of systems are kind of implicated in this. And they're all intertwined. And so, yeah, I think that working with the schools and ensuring, because gun violence is concentrated in places and among people who, tend to have many other of these sort of co-occurring outcomes co-occurring negative outcomes. And so when we think of gun violence prevention, it could be, the other pieces to that puzzle might be better access to healthcare and food security. It could be, housing access, education. All of these systems are kind of related to one another. They're all affecting one another. And so if we can leverage the resources of other systems, I think that's a really good way about to go about it.
We'll go back to our callers now. Terry joins us in Fifield. Terry, hi.
Hey, hi. My question is really kind of simple. This is all on gun violence, but if you take away the guns, they're going to grab a knife. If you take away the knife, they're going to grab a club. Why aren't we just delving in on the problem of violence and getting rid of that?
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. I'm looking at an FBI chart. Their most recent date is 2019. About 3/4 of homicides in the U.S. are guns, firearms of one sort or another. But Terry raises a really interesting question, Ted. Is this a gun violence problem or is it a gun violence problem? Should we be talking about preventing violence more generally, or is there something particular about gun violence that we're worried about?
I think it's both. I think a lot of the violence prevention efforts more generally, work for gun violence as well. And so I think that the nature of the violence problem, especially here in America, being gun violence, it's a question. The research community has been dealing with this for a long time. Some people refer to it as firearm instrumentality, and thinking about, if somebody is motivated enough to engage in violence, it doesn't really matter what tool they use. And, it's hard to say in a given event or incident whether if the gun wouldn't have been present had the violence still happened. One thing that we do have some there's considerable evidence out there suggesting, though, that firearms do make violent encounters more lethal. And so when we're thinking of loss of life, as opposed to having a non-fatal violent encounter, the research is pretty clear that the presence of a firearm does make these encounters more lethal. And so when we think of the ability to injure and or kill somebody from a further distance away, when you look at fatal shootings versus non-fatal shootings, a lot of times there's not a whole lot of difference in sort of the contextual or the situational characteristics of the incidents. And so what that tells us then is that at the same time, when you do have more wounds, more, you know, the placement of the wounds.
I will have to leave it there. Sorry, Ted Lentz is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UW-Milwaukee. Regular listeners know that we're big fans here at Central Time of the brown bears at Katmai National Park in Alaska. The bears are the stars of a series of online nature cameras, and this is a big time of year with Fat Bear Week voting just around the corner. It's been a dramatic season, including a later-than-usual salmon run, some confrontations at Brooks Falls, and the long-awaited return of fan favorite 420 Otis. Now the public, you, can get involved in voting. If you want to get in, just look up Fat Bear Week online. You'll find a pre-vote survey, links to the online cameras. Then over the next couple of weeks, you can vote in bracket-style competitions, first for Fat Bear Jr., the youth competition, then the full-on Fat Bear Week competition to honor the bear that did the best job gorging on salmon to get ready for winter. Watched a lot this year. I'm not a gambling person, but if I were, my money would be on 128 Grazer. Did a great job of catching fish on the lip of the falls, and she didn't put up with nonsense from anyone. There are a lot of great contenders, though. Search online for Fat Bear Week. Get in the game. This is Central Time.